Ow!
Those uncomfortable things we do for beauty.
Oof. Ouch.
And when it comes to whiter teeth, same story. Until now. Enjoy rinse-free whitening with new Sensodyne Clinical White. You'll get clinically proven whitening technology in an enamel-safe formula for two shades whiter teeth and 24/7 sensitivity protection. Sensodyne Clinical White. A whiter smile without the wince.
One, defining America, the five traits of American culture. Two, Kyrie Irving gave up $100 million for the vaccine, but many, many more gave up much, much more. Three, from the Cowboys to the Longhorns to the top 10 helmets in college football. It's the Will Kane Podcast on Fox News Podcast. What's up? Welcome to Wednesday. Welcome to midweek. As always, I hope you will download, rate, and review this podcast wherever you get your audio entertainment, Apple, Spotify, or at Fox News Podcast. You can also watch the Will Kane Podcast on Rumble or YouTube. Two fish were swimming along, two young fish swimming through the water one day when they happened upon an older, wiser, grizzled fish. As the older, wiser, grizzled fish approached the two young fish, he said, "Hey boys, how's it going today? How's the water?" The two young fish swam on. Some distance later, they turned to one another, and one of the young fish said to the other, "What the hell is water?" This is a story that I've borrowed from the tragic and famous author David Foster Wallace, who used this parable in a commencement speech some years ago. It's absolutely one of the most must-listen, must-see commencement addresses, I think, without overstatement, without hyperbole, in the history of America. What is water? Asks us to be aware of a very simple question. Everything. To be aware. To know where we swim. To know what we breathe. To know the choices that we make. To know how we think. David Foster Wallace presents to students in this commencement address the choice to go through life on default settings. To simply swim through life. Without ever looking around and knowing what guides those decisions. Without wondering what it is that we worship. In one of the most amazing moments in this speech, he says, you do not have a choice of whether or not to worship in life. You only get a choice as to what you worship. He walks through how your choices can literally eat you alive. Worship money and wealth, you'll always feel wanting. You'll always feel poor. Worship your intellect, you'll always feel stupid, a fraud, on the verge of being found out. Worship beauty and you'll die a thousand deaths with age. He proffers that you can do a lot worse than to worship an almighty. This speech, though, What is Water, to me, helps us in the conversation I hope to have with you today on what is American culture. The idea of America is often talked about in terms of governance, is often talked about in terms of democracy, is often talked about in terms of freedom. But the idea that there is a distinct and special and unique culture of America is rejected or scoffed or ignored or goes completely unaware, like water to the two young fish. Many people see America as the melting pot, as a convergence of many cultures, a multicultural society, and it is in so many ways. But that doesn't deny the existence of a base through line of American culture that defines not just America, but our choices, defines you and me, defines our identity, defines our past, and defines our future. I think the best that we can do is to be aware of what is this culture of America. In the past couple episodes of the Will Kane Podcast, I've talked to you about the threat of illegal immigration legal migration, even in unfettered terms, in terms of millions coming into this country and what it means for the future of American culture. A user on social media said, I don't know if as a challenge or out of curiosity, says, I hope at some point Will Cain takes the time to describe the, quote, established American culture, what it is and what it isn't. Today, I hope to do that. Today, I hope to talk about what is water. I hope to define what is the culture of America. Story number one. These five traits of American culture run deep into our character, into our past, into our history. These are the deep channels into the river that along which float our exports like popular music and movies, along which float our heroes, our business titans, our entrepreneurs, our Steve Jobs and our Andrew Carnegies, our John D. Rockefellers and our H.L. Hunts. On this stream, in these deep channels, is the development of rap music and country music. Within these channels, you'll understand the themes and the lyrics to which we gravitate. I think that these five characteristics, these five traits, define, in my humble estimation, what it is to be in America, what it is that has set apart America, and what it is that does need to be preserved, to retained, what it is that makes America great. Five traits of American culture. Number one, the individual. The United States of America, more than any society that came before, placed at the center of its political governance and also its cultural hierarchy, the individual. The essential political unit in the United States of America is the man. I do not mean that in terms of gender. I do not mean that to hear the rebuttal about the suffrage rights and then have a secondary conversation about civil rights. What I mean is, at the center of the American political question is the man, is the individual. A focus on individual rights. From this is the more popularly understood American characteristic of freedom. We didn't happen upon this. Our founding fathers didn't simply sit down with a blank sheet of paper and go, what's at the top of your mind, Tom? I don't know, George. What do you like? As though describing or asking or debating, like we will later in this podcast, the best helmets in college football, Benjamin Franklin and James Madison weren't shooting from the hip. They were immersed deep into Western Enlightenment and culture. They were immersed deep into education. The focus on the individual originated out of Greek democratic philosophy and rights, Socrates, Aristotle, Plato, but emerged later out of the Magna Carta in England that established that a man has rights independent of the desires and wishes of a king. After that, the American philosophical experiment understood the meaning and enshrined the ideas of men like John Locke, who proffered on the very nature of man, whether or not man could be trusted, and therefore man could be the center of your political universe. No, this wasn't a momentary fad. This was the evolution of thousands of years of thought. To this day, what? 250 years into our experiment, no other nation has come along and better enshrined in its documents and adhered in its whole culture to the idea of the dignity of the essential nature of the individual. Because you cannot have freedom without the dignity, without the focus on the individual. If you look through the foundation of the government of the United States, the political decisions, they were born out of a cultural decision that a man has certain rights granted by God, inalienable rights. And those were, of course, you've heard, the right to life, liberty, and property. They are the right to free speech. They are the right to free religion. The one characteristic that is common, though, to all of these rights is that they are what is known as negative rights. Negative rights, while it carries a negative connotation, is the most positive form of rights because it is focused strictly on the individual. It establishes what the man has a right to be free from. You have the right to be free from a mob, the majority, a democracy, a king, a president, a government, intruding upon your right to free speech, free thought, free practice of religion. You are free to do as you choose, and you have a right to be free from others intruding upon those negative rights. Today, though, in the United States of America, what you see is a cultural shift, one that's not begun here in the United States of America, I would say, but a shift that has been seen throughout the 20th century, a cultural shift that spanned across nation states. It was a cultural shift you could have seen in the Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, the USSR. It was also, though, enshrined, for example, in a constitution that at one time, one of our Supreme Court justices, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, lauded as a better version of a constitution than ours here in the USA, South Africa. It also shows rights that have been embraced in Europe and in Canada. And these are rights that are called positive rights, that you, by your very existence, have a right not to be free from something, but you have a right to something. You have a right to health care. In the Soviet Union and in South Africa, you have a right to leisure. You have a right to a home. You have a right to food. You have a right to things. But here's the problem with this utopian view of all these entitlements to which you have a right by virtue of being born. These things don't grow on trees. These things are not granted by God. These things are created by men. Healthcare, houses, homes, food production, these are all items, goods, and services produced on this earth by the labor of man. And if one person has a right to those things, that means that person has a right to another person's hard work, to their services, to their goods, to their time, to their labor. And if that's the case, if I have positive rights that then require you to labor for me, what are you but a slave? As a matter of fact, if I have those rights, then you do not have negative rights. If I have a right to a home, you don't have a right to be free to pursue your own property. Your property is now mine because I have a positive right to health care. Positive rights and negative rights cannot work together. They work in antagonism to one another. And positive rights are part and parcel of a culture that doesn't see as a center of its political unit the individual, but rather the group. You can see modern day examples of this, not just through the 20th century, but the 21st century as well. For example, when Canada enshrines hate speech laws. Here, Canada and others, like the United Kingdom, have placed the group above the individual. You won't say certain things as an individual. Your negative right to free speech will be intruded upon because of the positive right of the group not to hear such things, not to be offended. I was driving around Dallas yesterday, taking my son to soccer practice, and I was really taken aback by an ad on a bus, a metro bus in Dallas, driving around. And this bus had this written across the side of it. It said, "Protecting our communities together. Report hate crimes." I thought, wow. I mean, I know that we have hate crimes in the United States of America, but can anybody really define a hate crime? And why is that the province of, in fact, the FBI? The ad was paid for by the Federal Bureau of Investigation with a phone number on the side that said something like 1-800-CALL-FBI. This is a movement, a cultural movement within the United States of America to place the rights of the group above the rights of the individual. But core at our heart, at our history, at our identity, is the individual. It's why we have a constitution and a governance system based upon negative rights. It's why we are directly connected to being the most free society on the face of the planet. At the core of American culture is the individual. Number two, faith, family, and country. You cannot escape that at the core of American identity, at the core of American culture, is faith. And not just faith, but the Christian faith. That has been expanded over time to include the Judeo-Christian ethic. But that's not an opinion of Will Cain. That is an irrefutable historical fact, staring you right in the face at any moment that you attempt to understand American history. You look at the Constitution of the United States, you look at the Declaration of Independence, and what do they reference? They reference God. Rights, inalienable rights, granted by our Creator. Freedom of religion, right there in the First Amendment. But freedom of religion did not mean freedom from religion. We are not a secular state, meaning that we are governed or led by some secular philosophy. Our roots are planted in the Judeo-Christian ethic. Our documents evidence the roots of our history in faith. Let's go back to David Foster Wallace for just one moment. We, he suggests, as people, do not, again, get a choice as to whether or not to worship, but only what we worship. By that, what he's talking about, in some essence, is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. At the top of whatever you put at your priority, at the top of whatever you place at your hierarchical pyramid of decision-making will be, in the end, what you worship. And you will organize your decision-making process with certain priorities above others. If not, you will be simply an individual unit of chaos. I mean, think about that most rudimentary. You know, my kid is sick and needs to go to the hospital, but I also need to get in a workout. What's more important? What choice do you make? What's higher on the priority? Obviously, your child. You keep playing this out. I can, as David Hogg most recently put it, and we talked about in the last episode of the Will Cain podcast, choose to have a Porsche or choose to have a child. Yes, you are free to do so in the United States of America, but the choice that you make is the one you worship over the other. If you choose Porsche, you worship child. You worship Porsche over worshiping the child. You can keep doing this up the hierarchy ladder, up the decision tree, and at some point you'll arrive at the top. And there will be the answer to what it is you worship. You may think you have chosen not to worship. You may consider yourself an atheist. But you're not, because something is at the top. And as Foster Wallace lays out, maybe it's materialism. Maybe it's beauty. Maybe it's your own ambition. But you will place something at the top. And whatever that is at the top, you will in effect worship, choosing it above all other. In the United States of America, we're not a secular governance, a secular philosophy, one moving around chaotically from political party to one political party. We're not simply at the voting booth changing every 4 years who we think we are. Oh, yes, we have open arms. Oh, no, yes, we are multicultural in that we not only ask for, we encourage the best from other parts of the world, and we allow everyone to pursue their own faith. There is no official dictate of what you must worship. But we also are not free of religion. We're not free from religion, rather. Banishment of religion and Christianity from school classrooms, banishment from public life, from a high school football game, the banishment of public professions of faith at almost every level of American culture is a modern day phenomenon that would have been foreign to our founders, because right there at the center of who we are, written down early in the process, was at the core of our identity and core of our culture, was faith. I talked about the worship of the individual or the importance of the individual as a political unit, but that's not the end of the story in America. We also are a story of community, and at the center of community is family. We have, from the beginning, been built upon the idea that man should be free to raise his family, live free with his family, worship his God, and love his country. This type of mentality, for some reason today, is described as far right. It's fairly amazing to think about the journey we have traveled in the United States of America. From those foundering cultural ideals to the idea that they exist today only on the far right. Let me give you an example. In Italy, they just had elections for the newest prime minister, the newest governance in Italy. I'm going to forget her name. Meloni, I believe, is her last name. This woman has been described in American media as not just far right, but having roots in the history of fascism in Italy, tied to Mussolini. Why? What is it that Meloni, what is it that this new government in Italy professes? We can go back and you can listen to some of her statements. And they all go back to one thing, pride in the Italian identity, acknowledgement of an Italian identity, pride in God, pride in family, pride in country, faith, family, and country. And for that, she's a fascist. For that, she's far right. But faith, family, and country are not far right. In fact, they're core to the American experiment. They're core to the American culture. Number three, hardworking. The American culture of working hard. And this is often called the Protestant work ethic. Look, America's founding, not just ideals, but founding people were Protestants. They brought with them their faith, such as Calvinism. And as part of that, it was the idea of diligence, discipline, and frugality. Sun up to sundown. Early bird gets the worm. No, this isn't to say that other cultures and other countries don't work hard. But what it is to say is it was core to the American identity, to American culture. Do whatever it takes to get the job done. Not just that, but that there's pride and virtue in productivity. Look at it and ask why today we see a malaise, rising rates of depression, rising rates of suicide, rising rates of meaninglessness. I would offer to you it's because this is one of the cultural traits that we have lost. The understanding that within hard work, one can find meaning and purpose. This Protestant work ethic is part of who we are, and it's not to say a Catholic doesn't work harder, not to say a Muslim doesn't share similar values, but rather that this is part and parcel of the culture that is America. It came, let's be real, it came with immigrants. It came with immigrants from Scotland and Ireland, from Germany. They brought with them that cultural ideal, and it has persisted, as it will, into creating an economy that is the world's premier economy. That absolutely has produced the world's greatest wealth, the world's greatest goods. That for those that are still willing will wake up and see that if I work hard, I can still make of myself what I want. I can still be virtuous. I can find meaning and I can make a better life for my family. Four, adventurism. Core at the culture of America is the idea that man should push west. It started with the pilgrims sailing away from the old country, from Europe, braving the seas, arriving at an unknown land, living through starvation in winters they had only an inkling of the risk, oftentimes dying at the hands of Native Americans, all in search of a better life. That idea, that cultural ideal, that part of our identity, that part of our personality, absolutely persist. It's embodied by the pioneers who pushed west into the American frontier, risked getting scalped. I just finished watching 1883. You know, anyone who listens to the Will Cain podcast, how much I love frontier history. I love the history of Texas. I love the history of Plains Indians. I understand the risks that one would take when they said, I'm leaving Tennessee to go live literally on the frontier. To the western edge, all that existed was a plain, a great plain, a vast plain of high grass. And the most violent, warlike Indians on the continent. In Texas, it was the Comanches. In the Dakotas, it was the Sioux, the Cheyenne in Wyoming. The risk that it took to push west, dying at the hands, a violent death of being disemboweled, your baby speared, dying at the hands, perhaps laid onto a pyre of logs and burned to death, perhaps being staked out on the ground and letting nature take its course. A violent death was only one form of risk. You could drown, you could starve, you could freeze, you could die of heat exhaustion, and they did. As I was saying, I was watching 1883 recently, the sequel or precursor to Yellowstone, talking about a group of migrants from Germany that started out roughly 100 strong who wanted to make their way to the Oregon Territory. I believe two made it. That risk tolerance, that adventurism is part of the spirit and culture of America. And look, I say it persists in every way. It's embodied in the entrepreneur. It's embodied in the wildcatters of the late 1800s who went and drilled holes in the ground in the hopes of getting rich. I mentioned Hunt earlier. Rockefeller in Pennsylvania. It's embodied later in Steve Jobs starting a company on an idea. Michael Dell. There are too many to name. There's too many success stories and just as many failures. But that's our risk tolerance. That spirit of America is today embodied where there's no more frontiers in our country. It's space. Who leads the space race? Who carries the weight of the space race? Who places a man on the moon? The United States of America. And when the government ceases to fulfill that cultural ideal, what happens? Private enterprise steps up. Bezos, Musk will continue to push the frontiers, will continue to seek adventure, will continue to look for the frontier, will continue our risk tolerance. Trust me, this is unique to America. It's not to say you can't go to Europe and find an entrepreneur. But it is to say that it is in America you find more because it's who we are. It's why we are. We would not be here but for the people that were brave enough to not only leave behind all of their physical possessions, but also their family, their relatives, their culture, their history, to leave it all behind in search of a better world, a better future. If that's not risk tolerance, I don't know what is. We can't lose that spirit of America, sitting on the couch and playing video games, sedating ourselves with antidepressants, seeking comfort and not challenge. I do believe if there is one characteristic that is uniquely American, sets us apart most distinctly, it is our spirit of adventure. Number five, optimism. You cannot leave behind your old life if you do not think there's prospect for a better life. Americans are inherently optimistic. 15 years I lived in New York City, and by virtue of that, I got to make a lot of friends who came from other places on this planet. I'll never forget a conversation I had with a friend of mine who is Italian. And she lived for some time in the United Kingdom. She came to America and for the first time in her life, set out on an entrepreneurial venture, something she wanted to do in fashion. And she set about creating that business. You can't do that if you're a pessimist. You can't do that if you think the world and you and your future are only going to hell in a handbasket. You have to see optimism. But it's interesting she didn't do that while she was living in the UK, or for that matter, in Italy. And she said to me, it's because when you have an idea here in America, people say, yeah, absolutely. You could do that. You should do that. Do that. In the United Kingdom, you're constrained by class. You're constrained by culture. You shouldn't do that. It's not your place. It's not your spot. Your family doesn't come from a long line in fashion. Your family comes from a long line of something else. You're born into your status. You're trapped by your family, your history, your class, your culture. Not here. Here, you can. There's no guarantee you will. And there's no guarantee you succeed. But check back in with that risk-tolerant spirit of adventure in America. We are inherently optimistic by culture here in America. But that, like adventurism, is waning. People have an increasingly bleak vision of the future in America, of their vision in America. And all of these five characteristics, sadly, are on the decline. The understanding of faith, family, and country at the core of our identity. The placement of the individual as our essential political unit. Understanding we can find meaning in hard work. Risk tolerance to push ourselves to do something new, something hard, something challenging, something risky. But the optimism to believe, hey, I can do that. We can do that. If you think that I am too esoteric, too out there, that I've dug too deep in the channels of defining what is America, if you want to see it more in pop music or movies, if you think it's more about accents, I would say, if you don't accept my definition, my five traits of American culture, allow those who also acknowledge American culture but want to destroy it to define it. It was just a few years ago during the height of the race and identity crisis in the United States of America in 2020 that the African American Museum in Washington, D.C. put out a brochure, a two-page brochure on the aspects and assumptions of whiteness, defining, and I'm reading now and quoting, white culture in the United States. In this, they laid out the qualities and the traits of what they define as white culture in the United States of America. Here's what they had to say about white culture. In bullet point fashion, they start with this: rugged individualism. The individual is the primary unit. Self-reliance, independence and autonomy, highly valued and rewarded. Individuals assumed to be in control of their environment. You get what you deserve. There's the National Museum of African American Heritage saying rugged individualism is at the heart of what they say is white culture in the United States. Second, family structure. The nuclear family, father, mother, 2.3 children, is the ideal social unit. Husband is breadwinner of the household. Wife is homemaker. Children should have own rooms, be independent. They talk about emphasis on the scientific method as an example of American white culture. They talk about history, the primacy of Western, Greek, Roman, and Judeo-Christian tradition. On this, we agree, at the heart of American culture. They also highlight the Protestant work ethic. Hard work is the key to success. Work before play. If you didn't meet your goals, you didn't work hard enough. They say is not just at the core of American culture, but white culture in America. Again, if you do not want to accept my terms on the five traits that define American culture, listen to the National Museum of African American Culture. Religion. Christianity is the norm. Anything other than Judeo-Christian tradition is foreign. Future orientation, plan for the future, delayed gratification. Progress is always best. Tomorrow will be better. What's that? But Maya offering to you that optimism is part of American culture. Justice, based on English common law, I referenced earlier, the Magna Carta. Protect property and entitlements. Competition, this is back to adventurism. Be number one, win at all costs. Action orientation, master and control nature. Must always do something about the situation. Aggressive and extroversion. Decision making. This, according to the African American Museum, these are the qualities of white culture. I didn't mention they also say following rigid time schedules, punctuality, white culture. For that, ultimately, the National Museum of African American Culture apologized for this brochure, rescinded it, because punctuality is not the monopolistic province of white people, nor is optimism, nor is hard work, nor is Christianity, nor is Judeo-Christian ethic, nor is individualism, nor is the nuclear family, nor is rugged individualism. The museum here defines for us what is American culture, but says it needs to be torn down because it's actually white culture. And herein we get to actually how this culture applies to the history of the United States of America. This is open to everyone. And in fact, it has attracted everyone because it's produced a country, not just of the greatest success, but of the greatest freedom. And immigrant class after immigrant class has sought to wash up upon these shores, to avail themselves of the fruits, and dedicate themselves in many situations, in most situations, to the principles of this culture that is owned by no particular migrant class and no particular race, but is rather the culture of America. Listen to those that would tear it down, because they too will define it. And the only difference is those of us who understand that these are the deep streams. This is what guides us. This is what must be preserved. Because this isn't white culture. This is American culture.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
Fox News Radio on demand on the Fox News app. Download the app and just click listen. When you swipe left, you can listen to your favorite Fox News talk shows live. Swipe right for the latest Fox News Radio newscasts on demand. Fox News Radio on the Fox News app. Download it today.
Story number two. Kyrie Irving says he gave up $100 million in order to remain unvaccinated. Well, many more gave up much more. The last couple days, Kyrie Irving gave a press conference for the new season of the NBA, which we're headed quickly toward. And he said he was denied, you know, roughly a four-year, $100 million extension because he chose to remain unvaccinated. The Brooklyn Nets couldn't find a trading partner for Kyrie, and he couldn't cash in on that extension. He says he's been branded as a bad teammate who won't do what it takes to sacrifice for the greater good of the team. And he resents that slander to his reputation, and he resents losing that money. And he should. Kyrie should. $100 million is a lot of money, and it's enough that many of us would have gone, one or two shots, and I get the $100 million. I think a lot of us would have said, give him the shot, boss. Give Kyrie credit. He did not. But also we need to point out that Kyrie didn't sacrifice the most, because Kyrie will be fine. He'll still make tens of millions of dollars every year, and he'll still make, what is it, nine figures or more throughout his career. Not nine figures. Am I doing that right? Seven. I don't know. He'll make over $100 million. That's nine. He'll make over $100 million throughout his career. He's probably already made over $100 million within his career. Kyrie will be fine. But nurses, teachers, military service members have all lost their job because they did not submit to a vaccine mandate. A mandate that has been proven absolutely worthless. At this point, it's well known that the COVID vaccine does not stop transmission. Tweet that and people say, we know that it's supposed to stop the seriousness of the disease. Well, then what's the point of the mandate? The mandate is issued under the idea that you'll not get others sick if you get the vaccine. You don't need a mandate to keep people out of the hospital. The mandate was about transmission. I think at this point it's worth noting that Pfizer CEO Albert Bourla has just tested positive for COVID for the second time in 2 months. He was sick with COVID in August. He's had four shots of his own vaccine. He's sick again now at the end of September with COVID. Bang up job on the vaccine. It's really working wonders out there. And for that, people lost their lives, their livelihoods. Dr. Anthony Fauci, sick with COVID this past summer, four shots of the COVID vaccine. What was this mandate but a giveaway to Pfizer and Moderna? It wasn't for our health. It wasn't to protect us from transmission. That's clear. So what was the point in taking away those hundreds of millions of dollars from Kyrie? What was the point? Which NBA players did you protect? Which ushers, locker room attendants did you protect? What was the point in making our military weaker? What was the point in taking away the teachers that would educate our children? What was the point in reducing the staff members in our hospital when we were, in their own estimations, the midst of a pandemic that overclogged emergency rooms? What was the point in taking away the livelihood of everyone if it didn't stop transmission? And then there's this to support the decision of Kyrie. A new study published by nine experts from medical schools like Johns Hopkins and Harvard, including frequent guest here on the Will Kane podcast, Dr. Marty McCary of Johns Hopkins. Nine experts published in the Social Science Research Network said that the risk reward for young people on getting the COVID vaccine absolutely does not add up. That the risks have been severely understated. 18 to 98 serious adverse events for the COVID vaccine, including myocarditis and 3,000 other potential side effects. This, while their risk from death of COVID is minuscule for young people. Again, we've talked about this. This is while the vaccine is being taken off the shelves for young people in the United Kingdom, taken off, not being offered for people under the age of 50 in Denmark. We haven't been honest, and we certainly haven't calculated in the risk reward of the adverse effects of the vaccine. Instead, we've only sold it fraudulently that it would stop transmission, and then government mandates to force you into that choice at threat of your job, at threat of your livelihood. By the way, there's a new booster out. Right now, only 1.5% of eligible adults have chosen to get that newest booster. Just wait. Albert Bourla is working on it. He'll soon enlist the government, I'm sure, to force you to make that decision.
We're going to step aside here for a moment. Stay tuned.
Story number three. The best helmets in college football. But first, let's walk around the world of sports. The Dallas Cowboys beat the New York Giants on Monday night. I went live on Twitter after I do most Cowboy and Longhorn games. And what we realize is this. The Dallas Cowboys are an incredibly undisciplined team that, once again, are one of the most penalized teams in the NFL. Eight penalties for something like 70 yards against the New York Giants. It shouldn't have been close. The Cowboys had Daniel Jones under pressure all game long. Tank Lawrence, seven pressures, three sacks. Micah Parsons drawing so much attention. But because of offsides penalties or holding penalties, this game was closer than it needed to be. I will say, I'm not one of these conspiracy theorists thinks the NFL has it out for the Cowboys, because the NFL wants the Cowboys to be good. Their ratings gangbusters. But there were several. Noah Brown was absolutely mugged on two different occasions and no pass interference called. He was tackled in the end zone. Literally, he was tackled to the ground in the end zone. Ball's nowhere near him. No pass interference. Two guys grabbed him and played Red Rover with his waist on a fourth down play or a third down play with the game on the line in the fourth quarter. That's holding. Two guys, arms linked, holding him as he's trying to run past them. That's holding. NFL, you got to figure this out. You got some Cowboy fans that think there's a conspiracy. And I got to tell you, they're not sitting on nothing. But Cooper Rush has his second victory in a row for the Dallas Cowboys. Still, no quarterback controversy. Dak Prescott is our guy. That's a great victory for the Cowboys. How bad is the loss for the Longhorns? The Texas Longhorns lost to Texas Tech, and that's awful. And Steve Sarkisian's record right now when it comes to Big 12 play, top 25 play on the road is horrendous. But as much as I'm ready to begin the criticism of Sarkisian, I do have one interesting question I think I should ask. What would be Texas's record if their quarterback Quinn Ewers were not hurt against Alabama in the first quarter? He went down with an injury. What would be their record if Quinn Ewers had played the entire season so far? They're 2-2. I think I'm not being a homer to say I think they'd be 4-0. I definitely think the Longhorns would have beaten Alabama, one-point game, if Quinn Ewers plays the final three quarters. He was lighting it up in the first quarter. I think Quinn Ewers, if he's the quarterback that we saw in those first two games, I think he beats Texas Tech. Overtime game. And all of a sudden, Texas is 4-0. And Sarkisian's the toast of the town. And Ewers is a Heisman candidate. Now, here's the thing. That doesn't absolve what we see with his injury. That could have masked coaching problems that exist right there with Sarkisian. But, I mean, as long as you got a guy like Ewers, and then you move to a guy like Manning, you look up, and it could be several years before you realize you've got a coach with some issues. You're seeing it now. I mean, seriously. I don't think it's unreasonable at all to say the Longhorns would be 4-0 if Ewers were the quarterback. And if that's the case, there's an entirely different conversation nationally about Steve Sarkisian. Next, my top five quarterbacks in the NFL. Will's weekly quarterback depth chart. Here we go. At number five, it is the quarterback of the Philadelphia Eagles, Jalen Hurts. He continues to look good. The only argument against Jalen Hurts is who's he played. What defense has he played? The Commanders and the Vikings and the Lions. What happens when Jalen Hurts plays a better team? But right now, he can't be playing much better. At number four, Tua. No, I can't do that. Yes, it is. It's Tua Tagovailoa. I really almost think I should put him higher. He didn't pass the ball much. I think he was like 13 of 18. Highly efficient. Highly efficient in his victory over the Buffalo Bills. The Dolphins are all of a sudden undefeated. Should I have placed him higher? Because you're going to see I have a quarterback ahead of him that he just beat. I just can't fully buy in yet and rank him higher than fourth. But he's up from fifth last week. Maybe we should start believing in Tua. Look at the two Alabama quarterbacks right there from 1 year at 5 and 4. Hurts and Tua. At number three, Patrick Mahomes falls down a bit on the charts. Sneaky not playing so well last week. I think 55% completion. They lost their game this weekend to the Indianapolis Colts. Mahomes sliding down a little bit. And that leads me to number two, Josh Allen. 63 passes for Josh Allen in a loss to the Dolphins, but he played great. Here's what we've learned. Here's what I believe. The way that Mike McDaniel is playing Tua in Miami is the way that every successful team should play their quarterback. Cooper Rush is winning in Dallas with a coaching staff that's not asking him to win the entire game. We're going to drop some handy plays for you, and we're going to run the ball very well and committed to the run. Tony Romo was better once he started handing the ball to DeMarco Murray. Everything he did was more efficient then. Instead of him trying to throw the ball 50 times a game, 40 times a game. Dak Prescott was better in his first 2 years when they were trying to protect him, run the ball in simple game plans. As they've turned it over to him to throw the ball 40 times a game, now there are more questions. But that's not a Dak thing or a Romo thing or a Rush thing or a Tua thing. It's an every team thing. And my suspicion is that Josh Allen throwing the ball 63 times a game is not the way the Buffalo Bills are going to find themselves as a Super Bowl contender. They're going to need to ask Allen to play efficiently, not as a superhero, for them to reach their zenith as a team. So Allen's great, but don't have him passing the ball 63 times a game. All right, if I've said Mahomes and Allen, who's number one? Not Justin Herbert, who looked bad in a loss this weekend and has fallen out of my top five for the time being. It is a guy who jumped from, I believe, number four to number one. Baltimore Ravens quarterback, Lamar Jackson. He's just doing it, man. Rushed for 100 yards, threw for 4 touchdowns, 1 interception. Lamar Jackson is just behind Tua, I believe, in QBR. This year, Lamar Jackson, in my estimation, is the top quarterback in the NFL. Before I get to my top 10 helmets in college football, one more story from the world of sports. Deion Sanders, the head coach of Jackson State, is now the leading rumored candidate for every college football vacancy in the country. Georgia Tech, Nebraska. Who else has an opening? Georgia Tech, Nebraska, Arizona State. All. Could Deion Sanders be the next head coach of these programs? Here's what I have to tell you. Deion's not taking those jobs. He's already too big for those jobs. I believe that. He's pulling off recruiting victories at Jackson State that no HBCU has ever pulled off. And on top of that, he's winning. Deion lobbied for the Florida State job. His next big job out of Jackson State will be a big-time Division I program. He's not going to go to Nebraska and wonder if he can bring back that program. He's not going to go to Arizona State. Honestly, that's beneath him. Georgia Tech, not even close. At least I don't think he should. Deion has the legitimate ability to take the next big-time head coaching opening in college football. Power 5, winning history and tradition program, the next one that opens up. Now, your top 10 helmets in college football. Let's end off this episode with a fun subject. I'm 100%. Passionate and dedicated to my ranking. It'll no doubt upset many of you, but this is my list. At number 10, best helmet in college football, the Florida State Seminoles. Lower than most lists have Florida State's helmet. Florida State does something with their helmet that I find incredibly aesthetically appealing. All of the helmets, not all, but a lot of the helmets that I like employ this idea. Integrate the design into the entire shape of the helmet. I love the Cincinnati Bengals Bengal stripes, tiger stripes, all throughout their helmet. I think it looks great. I like it when the Eagles have wings coming off of the helmet. I think that Seminole spear running the lateral length of the helmet looks awesome. Feathers hanging down. It looks awesome. And I usually like maroon. I think maroon is a great college football color. Great high school football color. Something about maroon and gold I don't love together. I'm sorry, Florida State fans. I don't love that combination. Maroon and white, maroon and black, I like. Maroon and gold, eh. Maroon and yellow more, like the Washington Commanders. Like that look. That's a good look. Something falls just a little short for ranking higher on my top 10 list for Florida State. Number 9. The Arkansas Razorbacks. If you're not going to integrate it into the helmet, I like a simple, old-school logo on the side. I'm not big on words. More on that in just a moment. I don't love, for example, Gators written across the side of the helmet. I don't want to read your helmet. I want to see your helmet. There's something, I love the uniqueness. This is back to what we talked about in the last episode of the Will Cain podcast, provincialism and true diversity. I love unique. I hate generic mascots. Do we need more lions, more tigers? Do we need, what's a Razorback? Who knows? It's a hog. I love that. And I love the hog on the side of, what is their color? Not maroon, not bright red, crimson of the Arkansas helmet. Looks great. Number 8, the Miami Hurricanes. Good looking white U that somehow also reminisces a hurricane. It's not the symbol of a hurricane, but somehow we've come to associate it with a hurricane. Green, orange. The Miami helmet is simple and good. One thing you're going to see me return to is simplicity. I do believe if you're Oregon or TCU and you don't have like a historical tradition to which you need to devote yourself, then go ahead and let her rip. Don't get in the middle ground. I hate the middle ground. The middle ground is like USFL type uniforms, like the Denver Broncos. Go back to your old school uniform, Broncos. Same with the Patriots, New England Patriots. Go back. What was his name? Was it Patrick the Patriot? Pat? I forget his name. Buccaneers. That's another great example. I can't remember those guys' names. What was his name? Was it Bucko? I don't know. I'm sorry. But the pirate with the, you know, the knife in his mouth and the hiking patriot and the horse and the rider for the Broncos. I don't like these new USFL, new 90s. USFL, totally personalityless aesthetic. I like simple and old school, or let her rip, go Oregon, TCU, trick it out. Chrome it out if you have no history to live up to. Miami does. Miami's simple. I love it. Number 7, USC. Now, USC represents a new aesthetic entry for me. I don't think I used to love this. First of all, it's tradition. It's old school. But I've come to like the small, like Arkansas, the small, you know, logo and emblem on the side of the helmet. By the way, here's kind of a maroonish. It's not maroon, also not red. What are we looking at here again? Crimson and yellow. Maybe it's just your gold, Florida State. Man, I don't like gold with that color. I like the almost too small logo on the helmet, but old school, like it was developed in the 50s. I love USC's helmet with the Trojan on the side of the helmet. There's another good example of this right here that I've come around to at number 6, LSU. First of all, I love purple and yellow together. It's unique. Not many programs are carrying that color scheme. Looks great. And now you've got the small tiger with LSU above it. I don't know what I love about it. It's almost high schoolish. It's so bad that it's good. It's so aesthetically like, what should we do? Well, here's a little logo, and then we'll put our name above it. No, that would never have been designed. In the last episode of the Will Cain podcast, we talked about refinement culture. It's so unrefined. LSU's helmet, so unrefined. That's what it is. That's what I love about it. It's so authentic. No graphic artist would have ever come back with, that's what we should do on our helmet, what LSU's ended up with. And because of that, It looks awesome. It looks unique. At number five, Alabama. Why am I having so much? The Crimson Tide. Crimson. This is a crimson color. Man, I know my differences between red and maroon. Crimson's in that, like, no man's land between the two. OU, Arkansas, USC's a little darker, you know. Florida State, Washington Commanders, a little darker than ultimately A&M to maroon. I get the color scheme. I got it. I got the palette wheel. But where was I? Bama. Simple helmet, numbers on the side. Love it. I love the numbers on the side. That's uniquely Alabama. I'm sure some other programs do it, but that is uniquely, you see that, you think of Alabama. Would you rather them have like the elephant, you know? No, you don't want the elephant on the side of the helmet. I love it. The numbers, again, I'm into old school. I'm into old music, 70s country. I'm into old cars, K5 Blazers, you know, Broncos, old square body trucks. I'm into old, not, you know, I'm into white t-shirt, blue jeans, and boots. I'm not into, you know, fashion, whatever. Alabama defines that. Number four, perhaps the most old school and simple, Penn State. Penn State Nittany Lions, just plain white with that navy stripe. Looks so good with the navy. It looks so good with the navy jersey and white pants, but also with the white on white on white all the way down. Penn State, so simple, it's great. At number three, in the same vein, maybe a slight bit of homerism, but in the same vein, the Texas Longhorns. Simple, small, old school logo with the horns. Great, unique color scheme in burnt orange and white. Awesome helmet in the Texas Longhorns. At number two, Notre Dame. Those Golden Dome helmets. Plain, simple, history, tradition. It's everything. It's college football. And at number one, in the same theme, old tradition, but in this case, not just simple, unique, the Michigan Wolverines. Michigan does it all. They check every box. Unique and tradition-filled. Love the Michigan Wolverines helmet. That's number one. That's my top 10 college football helmets. At Will Cain on Twitter. See Will Cain on Instagram, Will Cain on Facebook. Give me your feedback. Tell me where I got it right. Tell me where I got it wrong. As always, I hope you will share this podcast with your friends. Leave it a 5-star review. Leave a comment. I'll appreciate it if you think it is so deserved. I'll see you again next time on the Will Cain Podcast.
I'm Guy Benson. Join me weekdays at 3 p.m. Eastern as we break down the biggest stories of the day with some of the biggest newsmakers and guests. Listen live on the Fox News app or get the free podcast at GuyBensonShow.com.